Welcome to Zeroed In, the podcast where we explore how the UK's road freight sector is driving towards a cleaner, more sustainable future. I'm Andy Salter, and in this first episode, we're joined by Johnny Williams from Vigo Bioenergy. Welcome, Johnny. I want to unpack some of the things that are going on for the year ahead here in the UK, take a look over the water, what's going on in Europe, but also take a few minutes to take a look back at what the 2025 brought for you as a business.
Hi, Andy.
It's been brilliant to have you here, Johnny, and thanks a lot for sharing your time and sparing your time with us today. I know you've got a big year ahead for Vigo Bioenergy. Before we get into your future plans, let's just take a quick look in the rearview mirror and reflect on 2025. You were one of our headline sponsors at the Motor Transport Decarbonisation Summit. How do you see the mood in the industry, or what were your key takeaways from the sort of, you know, that sort of sense that you get at an event? What's your view? Do you sense they're optimistic, sceptical, frustrated? How do you gauge the mood of the industry, and not only at the summit, but also in the conversations that you're having?
Well, you've got this interesting psychology, whether you're talking about the government or the stakeholders that are following zero emission fuels. As far as they're concerned, zero emission is a fait accompli. And therefore, looking in your rearview mirror, to use your term, and seeing the biofuels people still appearing, I think gave rise to some very, very interesting lobby and water cooler conversations. I thought those guys had gone. Why is it kicking up such an interesting set of conversations? And obviously, a lot of people trying to dispel the value of it. That's natural, but it did allow us to be able to have some very interesting conversations in relation to not only a competition, you know, like it's one versus the other, but how they can actually work together. This is not a one size fits all. For example, and I hope we'll talk a little bit more about it later on, is the idea that it's very easy to see that short distances, lower weights suit very, very well electric. Question is, does long distance, heavyweight, 44 ton, should we be throwing the baby out of the bathwater with ICEs? And of course, when I was having a lot of conversations with the EV stakeholders, they were nodding their heads significantly around that concept, you know, that they can coexist together. So that was very eye-opening.
I guess 2025, when you're looking back on that year, it's been, you know, we've heard a lot from you, and it feels like there's lots of deals to be done. You've been with the Uniserv contract, and I think you've got some others. Give us a bit of a reflection on that in terms of business performance and new customer acquisition.
Yeah, we've grown 5x since the previous year. We've been trading in the UK for 3. Germany is our main market. Currently, we've been adding, you know, I think we're up to around 60 stations now, something like that in the network across all of Europe.
Right.
And performance with regards to vehicles using gas has been exceptionally good. There's been, a number of reliability problems, as there always is across, you know, different OEMs. But generally, it's been a year of, how would one say, testing the mettle of some of the range and, you know, some of the duty definitions that you'd expect from haulage, testing gas against diesel, and in most cases, matching diesel and bettering it.
Right.
It's nice to see that when you actually put things into practice from what you actually believe, that you actually see them not only performing, but actually bettering what you expected.
And when you say matching performance with diesel, that's on a performance and a range point of view, bettering in terms of financial performance, or how does that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the diesel tracks gas oil, which, you know, tracks oil, gas tracks the gas market. Those commodities are up and down. They're influenced by geopolitical as well as local effects. We've seen gas prices dropping this year along with oil. It's meant that we've been able to see phases where diesel is a little bit more expensive than gas. Gas been a bit less expensive than diesel. The outlook is quite strong in terms of a commercial performance of one versus the other. But remember, these things are very, very close to each other, regardless of the market. there are a number of people out there still concerned about what happened in 2022. We don't see any of those events being affecting it in as much, because a lot of the infrastructure now is pricing in that sort of risk. So we see quite a strong, you know, a reversion to pre-Ukraine, where gas for 20 years was very, very low and very, very stable, certainly versus oil. So one never knows what's going to happen. It's you know, the geopolitical system is always a bit unstable, but we see a good, strong outlook for gas from an economic perspective. We've talked a number of times about the Uniserv example, but, you know, running their Volvo gas trucks. I think the last number I'd gotten from Gordon, who, as you know, joined me on stage at the conference, was that they were up to about 360 clicks.
Right. On a array.
That was their current, their annual current usage.
Oh, right. Okay. Right.
360. Yeah, yeah. I mean, they haven't done a full year yet, but that's what their run rate is.
And they're just in normal operation.
They just don't take the key out. They're on triple shift. They fill them up at the station, back at the depot, and off they go and come back again. So you're getting range, you're getting weight, but you're also clearly there, you're getting performance out of the truck. The great thing for the drivers is that when you run a Volvo, it pretty much runs like a diesel. So it's almost like you're getting into the same vehicle. All you're doing is putting a different fuel in there, but benefiting from all of this carbon saving.
So you mentioned there, Uniserv. It was great that you were joined by Gordon as part of the big debate at the summit. But it was also, we had Chris Batt from Asda, from the procurement team at Asda, talking about their experiences of biomethane. That's been another big company customer acquisition for you in 2025, wasn't it?
Yeah, really. I mean, Asda are, I think, officially the largest decarbonized fleet in Europe. You know, they run, I think it's around 1,100 to 1,200 tractors, yeah, of which a lion's share of those are LNG. Yeah, it was really great to hear Chris come on and give his experiences of running that. We often think about, I think most haulage companies, operators, hear of these small examples. You know, if you take even ZHID, which is testing EV and hydrogen, you're never going to actually experience it at scale, yeah, because the cost of the subsidies and so forth don't allow you to do it with big numbers. And then along comes Asda to tell us about, you know, how they've been doing it, not only at small scale, but at a very large percentage of their entire fleet. Mm. And we're talking 13, 14, maybe even 15 depots, all running this decarbonized fuel and giving their experiences. And of course, it's not, I think Chris's overview indicated that there are big differences and, you know, a lot of similarities. Yeah, I thought it was a really, really good thing to get up and hear about. And again, that was quite a big conversation piece afterwards.
Yeah. And they've come on board now with you across how many depots? And
it's pretty much split between, they're a very sensible commercial move to split between us and Gasrec.
Yeah.
So they run, I think if you sort of split it down the country, I think we're sort of on the right-hand side and they're on the left-hand side. Right. I don't think it's completely that linear, but yeah, generally they're sort of running a beauty contest, I suppose you'd say. But the performance of the gas delivery needs to be meeting Asda's very, very hard performance criteria.
Right.
The great thing about Asda and to a large extent Uniserv, but Uniserv is actually moving bottles, but not full bottles.
Right.
Whereas Asda, of course, it's moving critical.
Yeah, yeah, given the stores filled.
Yeah, it's mission critical. We haven't experienced it, but we know the theory of if that gas station isn't operational, what's going to happen to a town in the northeast that just has no food in it.
Yeah, yeah. That's a responsibility, Johnny, for keeping the goods moving.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? It's the sort of KPI, it's the sort of natural KPI that you want in order to be able to give you the credibility and validity of your product.
Yeah,
and you
like, I mean, like you say, the difference here is that it's at scale, and that's this is a big operator that's proved, you know, as we showed during COVID and other times, it proves a critical industry that keeps the economy moving. This is Zeroed In, our new podcast focused on the sustainability of the road freight sector and what the industry is doing to clean up and to decarbonize. I'm joined today by Johnny Williams from Vigo Bioenergy. Johnny, as part of the first bit that we've talked about here, setting the scene, looking a little bit back on 2025, I want to move the conversation on now a little bit to look at the policy, the regulation, the practical challenges that you can see. Still, we see a legislative and a policy framework focused hard on zero emission vehicles. What regulatory and policy frameworks are currently shaping the road to net zero for HGVs, and how do you think they should be refined?
Well, the current policy has rather topically just been affected by the European change, where the ban on ICEs for cars has been softened. That hasn't affected yet the UK, and I don't think it has affected the commercial trucking sector. I think it's very much focused on cars. I could be wrong. Andy's nodding at me. I think we're both in agreement here that
they're focused on where the votes are. So, and I think they've been heavily lobbied by the automotive sector, and they're making practical steps to make the implementation easier and less of a cliff edge for the market, which has got to be a good thing.
Yeah, I think they've softened it from like 100% to 90% or something, which probably gives you. But one imagines that that's a small fissure that will probably increase as the reality starts to bite. It gives us an indication that, like I said, you know, that the ICE, I mean, there's many people who will be listening to this who can't get their head around, you know, we're all sitting here talking about tractor units that are performing, you know, significant amounts of duty over just sitting in a car or even a van, right? And the reality of being able to replace, I mean, diesel's been around. A lot of people forget that diesel hasn't been around forever. I mean, it's only since the 50s, right? Mm. It basically changed the world. It was the sort of transport enlightenment was all about diesel, you could say.
Yeah.
We constantly hear about the ideas of EVs being way, way more efficient. The number of parts, the things that might go wrong are much less, and so on and so forth. But that, it does come with a big behavior change. And I think when we go to policy, I think when people are looking at this and they spend time, I keep repeating this, and I did this before, is to say that you can't just simply come at it from a psychological concept of thinking, okay, well, we had that, now this needs to be the way. Let's do it for cars, what we do for trucks. There has to be some real thinking. And as I said at the beginning, this is not about, I'm here advocating that gas should kill the EV idea. There are lots of examples where the government could embrace the concept of what they want, which is zero emission. But let's look at the practicalities of delivering goods with technology that exists, is well proven, and can decarbonize. And just to simply throw all of that out by saying that, you know, there's a carbon molecule coming out of an exhaust pipe. You know, one thing that might be interesting to listen is I have a theory that I think a lot of these policymakers grew up with science fiction films, Buck Rogers, Close Encounters, you know, in the movies. And you sort of have in your head that you think that the next transition from where you were with this sort of exhaust pipe, I mean, often in those old 70s movies, you know, the truck, it was like a chimney, right? And it's belching smoke out and all the rest of it. That's how you imagined a truck versus a flying saucer, which has no exhaust pipe whatsoever. And I often think that people are sort of hypnotized by the idea that they think they're going to conflate the two and turn a truck into a flying saucer. Mm. And suddenly, you know, that's the way the world should be because that's the future. And you create a policy almost like you're trying to have this dream of having a truck being in Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
So, interesting you say that. I've been listening to some other podcasts. There are other podcasts available, not just Zeroed In. And one of the things that I was listening to there was they were saying that most generally government policy reflects the prevailing university ideas of about 25 years ago. Yeah. And that, all those sort of people do their thinking at when they're at college or university or in those formative years. And then when they get into positions of governmental power, that's when then they enact it. And so always government policy is a reflection of a time that actually we're not living in at the moment. And that's a challenge, isn't it? That how do we keep our policy in step with what's going on today. You know, if you go back 4 years ago and everybody was very much focused on zero emission vehicles, sustainability is pre-Trump. Nobody was really talking about alternatives. It was, you know, it's the dash to zero emissions, and that's changed, doesn't it? You can feel that that's changed as a thing in society, that people are more skeptical. We've got lots of populist opinion. There's a whole, you know, sort of wave coming back from that started in the US that's coming back across the Atlantic and tempering everybody's views. And then we've got a planet to save. And yet we're still in the position that people are losing their nerve a little bit somehow. I'm not necessarily saying it's from a zero emission point of view, but from the whole of the decarbonisation efforts seem to be faltering. What needs to change? Because we've still got the planet to save. The planet's still warming up. I was reading something before Christmas there about temperatures in the Antarctic or Arctic. I couldn't remember which one it was.
Well, like, I think
they've been at their highest ever.
I think the policy, this doesn't just apply to transport policies, but I think it's across the board. There is no question that you need a scientific element to all this. That's what's driving us. We do theoretical modelling. We can explain what's happening with the atmosphere and, you know, and the emissions that are pumping into the atmosphere that are giving this sort of soup of problem that we can foresee out into the future. That's almost inarguable now. I mean, we went through a phase where, you know, and there still remains as many naysayers over carbon climate change as there are people who think that the Earth is flat. But I think that scientific element, it affects transport, is really, really important. But I think what we've also got to do is start listening to the OEMs, the haulage companies, as well as that scientific, and get more of an enriched, balanced view from all of those different elements. So I think one of the things I'm going to be working on this year is to work with Volvo and Scania and DHL and Asda and try and come up with some information that isn't just theoretical, that comes from real credible sources, and try to put that into some information that then people can start listening to. Because if you then challenge them and said, okay, well, have you actually gotten this information from people? Have you heard the data?
Yeah. That sounds great. Give us a little bit more flavor of how that's going to manifest itself.
Well, it's all about communication. With all of these theories, there is always an element of truth in everything. And what I think we've got to do is distill the truth, put it into something that makes sense, and then we can start making some proper decisions about what to do going forward. Yeah. And I think, again, we've got to have some proper conversations with the right stakeholders to inform the policies going forward that are going to be, they're going to look like we've actually talked to the right people and listened to them. Rather than wagged your finger at them and said, this is the way it's going to be.
Yeah, because I think that's the point, isn't it? This is where the end goal has to be reflected in a different way. The end goal doesn't necessarily have to be everybody's going to be battery electric. Our end goal is a reduced near zero carbon emissions from the sector. So let's focus on that rather than imposing deadlines that just cause market turbulence that may be useful for some people, but in general, it's going to be to the detriment of lots of businesses that are out there.
Well, I'll tell you another story about the psychology thing. The flying saucer is one other thing. How about when you talk to your children? I mean, we've got lots of drivers that enjoy having, all right, they've had to mess around with sticking PPE on and big gloves, whereas before they didn't have to with diesel. But to them, that actually is an indication that they're having to go through some different behaviors, but they're very, very minimal, but enough to actually show their kids, why are you putting the mask and gloves on? Oh, it's because I'm putting a decarbonized fuel in. And then they get some personal value from actually talking about that they're changing the world in their own little way, wagging their little finger in the ocean of change. Whereas if I think you started trying to get, yes, it would be fantastic to then say, I've got a flying saucer on wheels and I've electrified everything. But not if you're then going to have to start figuring out when you're going to get charged and having to go through all that range stress that I'm sure many people who run Teslas or electric bikes or even, dare say, an electric shaver knows all about the stress that you get when you're running out of battery.
So we've established that there's a world for biomethane and CNG, LNG, whatever it is. Give me a little tour of what's going on in that world and how you can give operators and users some confidence that they are using green molecules and it's not just all greenwash. Give me the selling job here, Johnny.
I touched on the gas can be delivered through mass balancing from all parts of Europe. So Vigo's investing at the moment not only in downstream more stations, we've also decided to, it's been very important for us to get involved not only with stronger relationships with constellations of suppliers of biomethane, but actually to build our own anaerobic digester plants.
And where are they?
So the first one that we have is in Lithuania. The main reasons for that, well, there's a number of main reasons for that. We happen to have some fantastic experts at project management and development that come from that country. We were very fortunate enough to acquire a team from there, superb people who've worked with some of our internal project guys. And we ended up delivering a station from pretty much T0 to gas output in 1 month less than we thought. This is unheard of in big projects, and less than budget.
And that's even rarer for projects.
Even rarer. That was to do with really strong project design. So as I said, but the Lithuanian effect is that all of the stakeholders, and I'm talking about getting a lot of the bureaucracy eased because of the jobs that it was creating, the farmers that are giving us the feedstock for the gas. So this is all manure based. Yeah. Generally, the cost between delivering gas from manure and food waste isn't that different. Generally about the distances that you have from obtaining the feedstocks. And we're going to continue to build that out. And we've got, it's quite interesting, a plant that's probably the size of about 4 or 5 different football pitches, which we build for about 30 million.
Right.
Gives you enough trucks for about 600 worth of trucks.
Right.
Which on the one hand seems small, on the other hand seems very impressive.
Yeah, There are anaerobic digesters in the UK, but there's none used at the moment for biomethane.
No, and you touched on that. I was going to mention that. The reason is that there are quite a large number of anaerobic digesters in the UK, but they're fundamentally still delivering to feed-in tariffs for electricity. So those are from sort of grandfathered legacy deals that the government did, which gave them long-term returns.
Right. Could you see a time when there are anaerobic digesters for your biomethane?
Yeah, we have conversations all the time about it, yeah. The interesting thing, though, of course, is that one of the elements of the Lithuanian value is to be able to deliver on time and on budget, or under time and under budget, is that be very difficult to do here.
Right, yeah.
Right, so the actual...
You're in the black hole of planning for starters.
That's right, the costs are quite significant. So it's a shame, but most of the efforts that we're spending at the present time is to develop countries like Lithuania, Latvia, Romania, even Spain, where you've got lots of cow and pig farming, chickens as well.
And I guess, as you mentioned already, the whole general acceptance of a mass balancing system, that's fine, isn't it? Does it? You don't have to have the means of production on site in order to be able to claim it. So what's not to like about that?
One of the things that sort of mentioned also is that it would be good to see some other OEMs appearing. At the moment, we only have the three.
Yes. Volvo, Scania and Iveco.
That's correct. Whispers of others coming in, particularly as of course, the hydrogen effect. It's not only the infrastructure or the choice of the operator to be able to think about hydrogen in the long term. It's, of course, it's going to be very, very in the crosshairs of the product teams in the OEMs for hydrogen, right?
Yeah.
Does it mean then that they're going to move directly to gas? To electric, or are they going to consider gas?
Take gas as the step to offer great like as we've said, great opportunities to decouple.
I think that will be the one. I think that will be the time when we should have another talk again, Andy.
You're listening to Zeroed In, the new podcast focused on the decarbonisation of the UK road freight sector. I'm joined by Johnny Williams. He's from Vigo Bioenergy. Johnny, I want to look a bit now way off into the future. Tell me what's going to happen in the next 3 to 5 years and how you, what you would like to see. We've spoken a lot about trying to pin the civil servants up against the wall and get them to see your way of thinking. What does this landscape need to look like? It feels that there is a big opportunity for biomethane. You need some certainty that they're not going to suddenly, people aren't going to change the rules again.
So how far are we going into the future? Is this when you're going to be inviting me over to drink some tea in your garden and we can talk about the good old days?
That's right. Put our feet up with our pipe and slip.
That's right.
I'm feeling quite relaxed about the 2050 when we're sat in my deck chairs looking out over the Sussex countryside. But there's a huge amount that's got to be done in that period of time. The transition is carrying, it's got a lot of weight that it's got to lift here. It's doing a lot of lifting for this industry.
I always come back to the National Grid moment when he was standing on stage.
At the summit.
At your great summit. Because that was always, it's always a great moment to be able to go back and look like that you were there. You know, and you said, well, don't worry, everybody. We've got enough infrastructure that we can put into the UK to be able to electrify your entire fleet. You just have to make sure your depots are underneath the power lines. And we were like, oh,
everybody's got to move their depot. This is the very first one that we did.
It was.
All your eyes. Yeah. The answer is you move your depot. Yeah.
You move your depot.
Yeah.
Now, I suppose if we had a blank sheet of paper, you know, that you suddenly etch-a-sketch the entire UK, shook it about and then said, okay, let's start again. Where would we put all the depots? Where would we put the trucks? Where would we put the shops? Where would we put the motorways? But it doesn't work like that, does it? At least the last time I looked, it didn't. Before we go through Alice through the looking glass and suddenly we're in a different paradigm.
Yeah.
No, we can't do that. We have what we've got. We've got, you know, a classic arterial route network with warehouses in the places that make sense to be able to deliver to the shops, to pick up stuff from the airports and from the docks and so on and so on and so on and so on. We have to build an infrastructure for power or energy that matches those permanent, immovable realities.
And particularly, there isn't, you know, we don't have the government and policy constructs as they might in other countries to make these big, long-term, 30-year grand plans. We've got to work within the framework that we've got, and that's
and all with a burgeoning population, and crucially with decision making that seems to be sort of limited to 4 or 5 years, when that decision making that affects policy is always like, okay, well, what's let's deal with the decision from the last time, getting ready for when you're two. It's like being in the middle of a quarter, you know, if you're a public company, you've just dealt with, you know, the results from the last one. Now you've got to figure out your next.
Yeah,
all of those forces are sort of against us. And this is why when one looks at it, I think you have to simplify what you can and then work on the complications that sort of make sense to continue to run a profitable business as easily as possible.
As always, a mine of information. It's been great to hear from you. Thanks for joining us on the Zeroed In podcast. It's been great to have you.
Thanks, Andy.
I think what we've highlighted here is how complex, but also how exciting the road to net zero and near zero is for our industry. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for our listeners for tuning in to Zeroed In. Stay tuned for our next episode, where we'll explore further how operators are implementing practical sustainability strategies on the ground. Thanks a lot.